Welcome, everybody, for the official microphone. I'm Kent Narum again, and this is session two of Conversation Around Ecclesiastes on Friday, July 1st. We're out on the Ark, and there's construction going on all around us, but we're still having a beautiful day. So, yeah, we were just kind of talking about with those who read Ecclesiastes' responses a little bit. The afterlife is not something that Ecclesiastes seems
focused on.
Well, but doesn't necessarily think it's, I would put it this way, doesn't necessarily think it's something that we can be sure about. The author of Ecclesiastes seems to think, if anything, we can be sure that death is death. That's about what we can be sure of. That life, that everybody ends. Everybody's life ends. Which is interesting, as our summer theme is under heaven. What does heaven mean to Ecclesiastes, to the author?
Somewhere, when I was little, I got a very immature notion of the reason you wanted to be a Christian is so you didn't have to go to hell. I don't know where that came from. Our whole culture. But later on, at some point, it became clear that heaven was going to take care of itself, and the benefits of being a Christian were sufficient within this lifetime to motivate me. I didn't necessarily feel I needed a cherry on the top of the cake and some image of heaven. And I've never sat down and tried to look where that notion fits in the historical theology. But it's very powerful for me, so not to worry so much about heaven as a payoff. But that's big in America, partially because of all the Luke's righteousness coming out of our Puritan theological heritage. There's a lot of Lutherans that are pretty puritanical, and so it's an issue for a lot of people in how we live with it.
Are you relating that to Ecclesiastes?
I think so, because finally what disappoints me in life is my dream that doesn't come true. It's not God's plan for me. It may not come true. So part, I think, what the author's lamenting is all of human plans that don't work out the way we expect them to, aren't satisfying enough.
Seems to me that Ecclesiastes just isn't interested in the questions of what happens after death. The focus is primarily about this life. Sometimes Ecclesiastes is talked about as having a kind of a Greek understanding of the world. We could talk about what cosmology we have, but how do you order time and space? In the ancient Greek world, there were three levels. There was the underworld, there was the earth, and then there were the heavens. And people spent their lives on earth as long as they were...
You bet.
Yeah, that phrase, under the sun or under the heavens, refers to that middle layer, that middle territory. And when you were living, when you were breathing, that's where people were. And it wasn't so much a question of do you ascribe to move to another place. That was your place. When you died, then you moved to the underworld. And it wasn't a punishment. That's where everyone goes. You are buried in the ground, in a sense. You cross the river Styx, I guess, as in more mythological language. But everybody died. Everybody went to the underworld, went to the ground. The heavens was the place that was reserved for the gods, if you move into that kind of mythology, the celestial beings. It was just different places for different beings. And Ecclesiastes kind of seems to a lot of the Hebrew scriptures seem to follow this kind of layered thinking. But I think Ecclesiastes, if we're kind of talking around the topic of heaven, Ecclesiastes offers this alternate approach to life, which is that it's not necessarily about what happens later or afterwards. It is about the now. And it isn't even so much about love of neighbor, which many of the writings of Jesus, the teachings of Jesus, maybe focus around. What is it about? It's about enjoyment. I'm going to read, as long as we're kind of moving in this direction, sort of three places where I think Ecclesiastes gets to maybe the heart of what Ecclesiastes wants to say, besides that it's utterly absurd, that it's all pointless, which is how the author kind of opens. But then as Ecclesiastes moves to the heart of what he wants to say, to me, these are three places that he seems to get as close to the heart of what he wants to say as anywhere. So chapter 7, verses 15 through 18. You can look it up. You don't have to if you want to follow along. Chapter 7, verse 15 through 18. In my vain life, and again, vain here is in my Hebel life, in my life that is as fleeting as vapor, as mist, I have seen everything. There are righteous people who perish in their righteousness, and there are wicked people who prolong their life in their evil doing. Do not be too righteous, and do not act too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? How is that for a verse in the Bible? Do not be too righteous. Don't be too good. And don't act too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Also, do not be too wicked, and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you should take hold of the one without letting go of the other. For the one who fears God shall succeed with both. Is this surprising to hear in the Bible? Moderation rather than the world being separated between good and evil, with the goal being constantly strive for the goal, move towards heaven, if you want to think about that three-tiered level. Enjoy where you are now. Live in the tension between this world that we tend to divide between good and evil. Hold on to both of them. It's a different way of thinking about good and evil. It's got some... I'm no Zen Buddhist master, but I mean, does it have some Buddhist kind of overtones? The yin and the yang? The
balance?
And it kind of makes me think this is probably a really favorite of that way of thinking to Jehovah's Witnesses, because how they believe that not all that many people will go to heaven, so they're already prepared to go to the underground. Would that be correct?
I have no idea. I'm not very well versed in Jehovah's Witness. But again, to me, it's not a concern about the future, the past. It's about, yeah, it's about now. It's about living in the present.
For me, it strikes that so much of human nature wants to have this battle between the good and bad. And in many ways, a lot of the things that make me unhappy is when it's something that I've come to really see sinfulness as wanting my will over God's will in many ways. And so when my plans get too intricate and too demanding and too powerful, it's when they're clashing with the reality around me that I find myself getting upset. So finding this middle ground where there's more balance may mean I'm not chasing after my own idols as much.
That the pursuit of righteousness can, how do we put it, have its own temptations and traps.
Well, pride is just, when you think about it, probably does us under as much as anything. That when we have met the righteous. And that's where Galatians says we're saved. What we do in our lives now may make our life better or worse, but it's not going to have anything to do with our salvation unless we turn our back on God.
So there's a C.S. Lewis quote that I just read. I'm probably going to forget the last half, and then about humility. Humility isn't thinking less of yourself. There was a really great punchline for the second half. But in my memory, it resonates with this not pursuing righteousness, because a pursuit of righteousness has its own traps, its own temptations. Another one, chapter 8, verse 15. So I commend, every once in a while Ecclesiastes does get into these interrogatives. This is what you should do. Doesn't necessarily say should, but in the same way that the commandments say thou shalt or thou shalt not. But I commend enjoyment. I looked up this word enjoyment because I was curious about what it is. Is it hedonism? Is it, you know, extravagant, you know, what is it? And it's the same word that we find in the Psalms, all the word, rejoice and be glad. Mm. So it's rooted in joy. It's rooted in gratitude. We can talk more about what that means and what it doesn't mean. But so I commend enjoyment, for there is nothing better for people under the sun than to eat and drink and enjoy themselves. For this will go with them in their toil through the days of life that God gives them under the sun. Again, this kind of focus on the present, living in the present. And then one last one, chapter 9, verses 7 through 9, a similar thought. Go, eat your bread with enjoyment, and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has long ago approved what you do. Let your garments always be white. Do not let oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life, and I'll translate this, enjoy life with one whom you love. All the days of your hevel life, your fleeting life, your pointless life, that are given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life, and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. So these words that keep coming up again and again, enjoyment, but also work. There's a real focus around the question of work and what is the purpose of work in Ecclesiastes as well. I'm curious what kind of Holden reading you might take of work, those of you who've been here doing Forerunner Week work or volunteering here.
Just doing something for a purpose.
So what's the purpose?
It needs done. What would you consider purpose?
It's a good question. I think Ecclesiastes just keeps asking questions.
How would the actual Hebrew in 9 be translated? Because on 9 it says, "Live joyfully with the wife."
Yeah, so read a little bit of commentary on this particular word. There's only one word in Hebrew for both woman and wife. So you hear the word, and you have to decide, is it talking about a woman? Is it talking about a wife? It seems like Ecclesiastes probably does have a male audience in mind. He uses a lot of masculine pronouns. And so the question is, what is he talking about?
Yeah, what is that meaning?
Yeah, I think there's some ambiguity about it. I think there's possibility for opening it up to be the one, translate it, the one whom you love.
Which verse?
9.
Or love the one you're with. There's
yeah,
that song.
Love the one you're with. Love joyfully with the wife. How does yours in German?
Nine.
Were women kept mostly illiterate way back then, so maybe he was just addressing people that couldn't read? I thought that's true.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it's hard to know. You know, a lot of languages still, and English is still wrestling with this as well. A lot of languages, Spanish, French, will present, well, like Spanish, for example, if there is one woman in a group of 100 men, if there's 99 women and one man, and you're referring to that whole group, when you say they, it's a masculine they. Because there's at least one guy, so that's kind of the trump card. Is there a little bit of going on here? Possibly, that it's assumed, I think that's one way to read it, that it's this language where, you know, we used 20 years ago in English language, we would say, man doth, you know, eat his bread, and we would mean all humanity.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm not sure I pick up a gluttony thing in there. When I think of some of the creation narrative, and you're talking about, we're supposed to live well, and we're supposed to have work. We're not supposed to have things handed to us. You're supposed to take care of yourself as you can. But this whole thing of appreciating that rather than trying to move toward a more gluttonous kind of a consumption. But that was the initial plan for humankind, was to celebrate being created in many ways. Well, we were alive. I think that, I don't know if I could even find proof passages for all of it, but that's a theme that seemed pretty strong to me. So in some ways, maybe saying the biggest problems we make are our own, and our own plans and our own sense of having more than somebody else, or not sharing, or not caring, and all of those pieces, that just gets us deeper and deeper into the mire, and pride can be one of those pieces of it.
A couple other things about this passage. One, the question of marriage is the author of Ecclesiastes, is Ecclesiastes talking about marriage in this case? So from Ken Stone, readers of this passage are frequently tempted to see in it praise for marriage. In this temptation, they are assisted by translators who render this verse, verse 9, as enjoy life with the wife whom you love, or enjoy life with your wife whom you love. As there is no Hebrew word referring specifically and exclusively to wife, the meaning wife must be inferred from contexts in which the Hebrew word woman is used. I was talking about that as that double meaning. Should one simply assume then that wife is to be understood here? Certain features of the passage may cause us to think otherwise. The word woman has in this instance neither a definite article, so it isn't the woman, the wife, as NRSV misleadingly implies with its translation, the wife, nor a possessive pronoun, your wife. There's no your. Literally, we have simply a woman whom you love. The fact that translators so often render a general recommendation in a more determined and definite sense, the or you, instead of simply a, already raises suspicions that normalizing sexual assumptions are being imposed upon a verse for which alternative interpretations are possible. So this author is at least saying, let's hold open these different possibilities, which I think Ecclesiastes would appreciate in some ways. In fact, numerous commentators note, though occasionally with discomfort, that when this verse is read together with the probable reference in 2:8 to physical sexual pleasures with women, and in light of the fact that there is here no definite article on woman, one can more plausibly conclude that Ecclesiastes does not have marriage in particular in mind. As one commentator puts it, Ecclesiastes was certainly no apologist for the marriage institution, whether or not you go with that or not.
Whether Solomon really did write it or somebody following him in his belief, maybe after his 1,000 women, he was kind of not sure of all of that, what it all meant.
Sure. How about if we switch gears just a little bit? We've talked about kind of specific theme that Ecclesiastes is circling around, but I want to get into situating Ecclesiastes in the bigger picture, in the overall Hebrew scriptures to some extent. And first of all, kind of doing that by bringing in a little bit of Richard Rohr and his idea of second half of life issues. Read just the very beginning introduction to this to give you a taste of it. Some familiar with Richard Rohr a little bit, and second half, I'm trying to remember if somebody had said that they read this or not. A journey into the second half of our own lives awaits us all. Not everybody gets there, even though all of us get older and some of us get older than others. So he isn't just talking about hitting midlife when you hit your, I don't know what midlife is anymore, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. A further journey is a well-kept secret for some reason. Many people do not even know there is one. There are too few who are aware of it, tell us about it, or know that it is different from the journey of the first half of life. So why should I try to light up the path a little? I'm driven to write because after 40 years as a teacher, working in many settings, religions, countries, and institutions, I find that many, if not most people and institutions, so he's not just talking about second half of life for people, but for institutions as well, that many, if not most people and institutions, remain stymied in the preoccupations of the first half of life. By that I mean that most people's concerns remain, and so here he's laying out what the first half of life issues are. Establishing their personal or superior identity, creating various boundary markers for themselves, seeking security, and perhaps linking to what seem like significant people or projects. These tasks are good to some degree and even necessary, so he's not saying that this is to be avoided. We are all trying to find what the Greek philosopher Archimedes called a lever and a place to stand so that we can move the world just a little bit. Was it Archimedes that said, give me a big enough lever and the right place in the world, and that he could move it. The world would be much worse off if we did not do this first and important task. But in my opinion, he goes on, this first half of life task is no more than finding the starting gate. It is merely the warm-up act, not the full journey. It is the raft, but not the shore. If you realize that there is a further journey, you might do the warm-up act quite differently, which would better prepare you for what follows. People at any age must know about the whole arc of their life and where it is tending and leading. So, first half of life, does this resonate with you? It's a bit of the rat race that we get into. How to get ahead, how to get a career, how to build a family, how to own a house. What are some other things that you think of when you hear those kinds of things? How to create an identity for yourself. I mean, it's easy to paint this with as bad or not good or lesser than something else. But Richard Rohr is again and again saying this is important to go through the first stage of life. You can't get to the second stage without going through the first half.
Well, and I think modernity points us so much toward career and reputation and power and wealth, and you look at all those things, and in some ways that's even made this a greater tension, because there are a lot of people who aren't sure which road to take because they're afraid it's the wrong one, and there's a lot of people who are so anxious to accumulate, fill their barns, New Testament language, that they disregard everything else.
Mm-hmm. Which is, can I say, is interesting, because July 31st, the readings, the one day of the three-year cycle of readings where Ecclesiastes shows up, that's the New Testament lesson where Jesus gives this parable of this guy who builds bigger barns for himself and says, you know, I got all this stuff, I better get more storage units for it. But partly I want to bring this in because this is again from Richard Rohr, but he quotes Walter Brueggemann in the way that Brueggemann talks about three different types of writing in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Scriptures. So the Torah, the prophets, and the wisdom literature. And Brueggemann says the Torah, or the first five books, corresponds to the first half of life issues that we've been talking about. This is the period in which the people of Israel were given their identity through law, through tradition, through structure, through certitude, through group ritual, through clarity, and through chosenness. And he says, as individuals, we each must begin with some clear structure and predictability for normal, healthy development. That's what parents are giving their little ones: containment, security, safety, specialness. Ideally, you first learn that you are beloved by being mirrored in the loving gaze of your parents and those around you. You realize you are special and life is good, and thus you feel safe. Any stories that come to mind around the Torah that help us think about, you know, generally those first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. I don't know, is there a story that, you know, certainly that getting the, receiving the Ten Commandments from God, like a parent, you shalt not. Rules are helpful, aren't they?
Absolutely.
In society?
The story of Joseph's kind of like a coming-of-age story, where he starts off as just like a nobody, but then works his way up to great power.
Mm-hmm. Boy, and he climbs the corporate ladder, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Second major portion of Hebrew Scriptures is called the prophets. And I think Richard Rohr maybe would see the prophets as the turning point between the first half and the second half of life issues, possibly. This introduces the necessary suffering, stumbling stones, and failures that initiate you into the second half of life. Prophetic, so kind of a catalyst. Prophetic thinking is the capacity for healthy self-criticism, an ability to recognize your own dark side as the prophets did for Israel. Without failure, without suffering, without shadow boxing, most people and most of religion never move beyond narcissism and tribal thinking. This has been most of human history up to now, which is why war has been the norm. But healthy self-criticism helps you realize you are not that good, and neither is your group. It begins to break down either-or dualistic thinking as you realize all things are both good and bad. This makes all idolatry and the delusions that go with it impossible.
It strikes me with this common theme in a lot of literature and secular, it's a time where you settle. Mm-hmm. And more or less you accept both your own and the world's judgment and whether you did okay or not, and that leads to other drama.
And I think the prophets maybe isn't so much settling. Maybe we'll get there with wisdom literature.
No, but I think that's one of the themes that's out there today. Mm. And may not be the answer, but it's out there.
Okay, I see. But the prophets are this restlessness.
Yeah.
They're this critique. They're this deconstruction of identity that people have made, maybe. Wisdom literature, many of the Psalms, Ecclesiastes, the Song of Songs, and the Book of Job, here you discover the language of mystery and paradox. This is the second half of life. You're strong enough now to hold together contradictions, even in yourself, even in others, that the person is the source of both righteousness and evil, that both can be held together and really should be held in tension with one another. And you can do so with compassion, forgiveness, patience, and tolerance. You realize that your chosenness is for the sake of letting others know they are chosen too. Yada, yada, yada. Is this helpful? Is this, how do you situate your own life, your own communities in these ideas? Was it a terrible question, or did I stump you? You're just thinking.
I think the word empathy came to mind. Living in somebody else's shoes a little bit within the community sense, that you're aware of their hurts and needs as well as your own.
Some folks who haven't shared yet or haven't talked yet?
I feel like I'm coming in late to the conversation, and I'm sorry for that. But to me, it struck chords of both the complexity of living in a community as well as the importance of it. And how each one of us has a role in relationship to every other person. And that's not a brilliant statement. It's an obvious statement, but this just seemed to say that well.
Interconnectedness.
Yeah.
Others who haven't shared yet, you can also say, "I don't know what the heck you're talking about." Pastor Cam.
Does it maybe tie in to Ecclesiastes 7, verse 20, which is the when I did my homework, that was the one verse that just really resonated. Surely there is no one on earth so righteous as to do good without ever sinning.
He almost sounds like a Lutheran there, doesn't he? All have fallen short of the grace of God. But is he getting at something else there? Or what did it say to you? What resonated for you?
It fits in with the fatalistic theme of the whole book of Ecclesiastes that seem to run throughout, but it also sets up the stage, if you will, for why it is so important that Christ will come.
Say more.
I but I don't know anymore. I'm not sure, but I just, when I read that in light of everything else, it's sort of like, okay, there's no one on earth so righteous that as to do good without ever sinning. Mm. That doesn't mean we don't try to do good. Mm. It doesn't, but we're going to blow it. It's just a matter of that we're going to blow it. And that's where the whole need for forgiveness and grace comes into being. It is very Lutheran.
Other thoughts? Just enjoying the sun? Everything under the sun?
Everything under the sun. Well, when you talked about the Torah and the three different categories, it reminded me, and I think maybe this was your point, of the progression of, our youngest people, children, have to see things in black and white. I mean, they just do, and they... it's very confusing to kind of blur the... I mean, it's not until maturity happens later that you're able to deal with paradox and contradictions and stuff that Ecclesiastes is just full of. I think we need to be further along on our faith journey, and maybe that's sometimes why I get hung up in this. I'm not... You know, I'm still growing, and not that I'm a black and white person, because I've been seeing gray for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. But it's just it's a depth of understanding of humanity that just takes some living into life. It's stepping into each decade of life.
Is there, I don't quite know how to put this, but is there a sense that if you're asking the first half of life questions, then Ecclesiastes doesn't make a whole lot of sense?
Mm-hmm.
That Ecclesiastes will seem really pessimistic, will seem fatalistic, will seem...
Confusing. Yeah.
Which is not a, I don't know, it sounds like a judgment. But I guess I'm trying to open up another way of hearing Ecclesiastes. Like Luther, in the quote that I read in last week's session, or the first session, the aim of Ecclesiastes is to set people at peace, to set people... to not live in anxiety and fear.
The first half, if you're shaping your identity yourself, who you are, then its advice is don't get carried away with yourself in doing this, in a sense.
There's no question Ecclesiastes is doing lots of deconstructing.
Yeah.
And so if you are engaged in the work of constructing, which is, again, Richard Rohr affirms is really important work, and in some sense, if you think... that you're ready to move on to the next stage, you may or may not be. You might still have to do the work of that first stage. And it might not be like, well, I'm 42 years old and now I've moved into the second half of life. You know, we oscillate between these two things, and we learn lessons and then we unlearn them. But Ecclesiastes is much more concerned about unlearning lessons. This,
a long time ago, somebody said the only difference between a child's faith and a mature faith is experience. And I've never quite unpackaged that enough to know where I'm totally at with it. But the idea that our faith experiences provide support and something to share with the younger person. But at the same hand, as we understand resurrection, and faith involved with that has nothing to do with how much... But that is a human thing. We try to decide, I have more faith than you have. That kind of question is out there. So I think in that sense, to say, rest with your... And do your work and enjoy your food, da-da-da-da. But that's not the key thing. It's how you get through it.
Maybe we can come at it from another angle. Come at Ecclesiastes again. Do you agree with Ecclesiastes? With all these, is life pointless?
I hope not.
How come?
Compared to heaven. The hereafter.
Say more.
If they're simply in the ground, and if they're in a cemetery, we can go and talk to them and hope they're having a good time down there. But, you know, how do we look at that?
Well, in one way, you know, when you think of a guy, and he's going to remember me 100 years from now.
Which is a question that Ecclesiastes asks. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to be remembered. That's true. Well, I have generations of people buried in my life that I know nothing about.
But that doesn't necessarily render your life pointless, I don't think. I think we can find meaning in the moments of now. And maybe if you look at the grand picture, you might like be able to see more of a pointlessness in the overall scheme of things. But I think meaning and a point to living comes.
Gonna ring the bell. Might plug your ears. Bus departure in a couple minutes. So, sorry. Continue.
So just. If you really maybe stop to think about it and maybe potentially fall into the hole of overthinking, you could find the pointlessness. But I think I think most people can pretty consistently find fulfillment in just everyday moments, and therein lies like the meaning or what makes life worth living.
Well, I think it does for us now.
But that's looking out into the future.
Where is now?
What's that?
I think it's there's meaning for us now as we live.
Right, but the 100 years from now part, that's where we get to heaven. And that's where we get the meaning from this. Is 100 years from now, maybe nobody on earth is going to remember me, but I'll be with God in heaven. And that's how we can get meaning in this life, even if looking at the grand scheme of things, we're like, yeah, nobody's ever going to remember me, but God will remember me, and that's what's all it seems. Maybe not to Ecclesiastes, but that seems to be the general Christian idea.
The word vanity, over and over and over again. And when I finally got to the end of Ecclesiastes, it was almost as though the whole book, taken as a totality, is saying, don't get hung up on self-importance, because that is really pointless, that we are a bleep in time when it comes to eternity and the whole big picture. But I agree with these guys that it doesn't mean that what we're doing is pointless as long as we're not doing it for self-grandizement. And yet, in some ways, we are, and we need to acknowledge that, which takes us back to the whole thing of sin and forgiveness. It's hard to... I mean, I think of my own career path, and I'm old now, and I'm on that second half tier. But when I think of my own career path, what decisions did I make? What choices? What did I do for people that fall into the category of it was really more about me than it was about the kids I taught, the people I represented, or whatever. Was I doing those things for me, or was I doing it for them? And that's the important question to always be mindful of. And at some point in life, when you are no longer resume building, career building, family building, and doing all of those things, then finding purpose in the second half, and that personally for me has been a challenge.
Because we can be, I suspect, I'm not retirement age, but we can be as caught up with first half of life issues in retirement as we are in our 20s and 30s. Is that true?
I think so. To some extent, yeah.
Different. But
I don't know. I have the sense of first half of life, the way Richard Rohr kind of presents it, you're working, and a crisis happens, whether that's losing a job, losing a loved one. Experiencing loss is often a crisis, whether it's loss of control, loss of anything. And it puts you back down at the bottom of the ladder. And you have an opportunity for this crisis to move you into the second half of life. But so often, instead, we just start climbing up the same ladder again, trying to rebuild that identity.
Or we become bitter. I've done a lot of really, quote, failure that turns into bitterness. But it may not be failure in the world's eyes. It may be personal failure. But it becomes angry and bitterness.
How have you learned to move through loss, to emerge beyond loss? Because I think that is partly what Ecclesiastes is getting at. When you ask these hard questions, how do you emerge to something new rather than just repeat the same old everything under the... There's nothing new under the sun, right?
Kubler Ross gets that to some degree, because in my case, every time I've lost someone close, and some of them have been struggles, I have to... There needs enough time for me to get past my own hurt and put the thing into a broader context.
When I hear broader context, I mean, I hear others naming this hope for something bigger. If we call it heaven, if we call it being with God. And I don't want to... I hope you don't hear me as dismissing that as a real way to move through loss as well.
Personally, I think the second half of my life has been wonderful so far.
You shed a lot of the pain of youth, things you worry about that are foolish to worry
yep.
about. That's
you
been.
Don't have to worry about.
There's both pain and liberation in aging.
Absolutely.
And the pain is in the joints and sometimes in the heart. But there is a liberation. I think that's maybe in part what you're saying. There is more of a peacefulness because you are no longer as concerned about, I'm going to just refer to it as resume building, which envelops
Figures.
The whole.
You don't have the worries.
Doesn't the worry about resume building come from the second half of life people?
Say more.
Like, I feel like for me as a young person, all of those worries are because of societal expectations on me.
But you're trying to impress the second half people.
or not even that I'm trying to impress them, but just to not look like I have no idea what's going on. And I guess, so it seems to be a contradiction there. Like that, I don't know, like, I might be generalizing too much, but if we think about, like, the second half of, like, people letting things go, they're letting it go and then pushing it on to the younger people somehow.
Interesting.
I don't know. Like, I just started thinking about this just now. So
there may be part of the word maintenance. I find myself maintaining what I found is my niche in the world. And so there's still some worry. And there's still some awareness of that. But it's more sustaining or maintaining kind of
okay.
feeling for me rather than much the other direction. That's a personal response.
Yeah, and it might just be me too. I don't know either.
I think I can kind of hear what you're saying. Like, the second half of life, people that have reached that level, they maybe, like, are the ones that establish the platform for which younger people have to aspire to reach.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, I don't think it's a conscious decision that anybody makes. Like, I'm going to put this expectation on you. It just kind of is the way it works.
It almost seems like that. It's you're describing the human condition. It's not really it's just something unique to this culture, but perhaps that's kind of
human nature.
How life plays out.
Well, it is a cultural concept. This is the expectation of you as a young person to meet certain goals or expectations, having a family, having kids, and that's somewhat changing now. That's a huge change in our culture. Well, average age for a woman now is 27. It was 21 just 10 years ago. That's a huge change in a very short time. 40% of the kids are not born into traditional family situations. Those are huge cultural issues. So it should be confusing.
We've got about 10 more minutes. How about one more way to circle around into Ecclesiastes? So wisdom literature is a really broad category. It includes books in the Bible. Some psalms are considered wisdom literature, not all of them, but a few of them. Proverbs, the book of Proverbs, the book of Job, the book of Ecclesiastes, broadly speaking, fit under the category wisdom literature. You can also find it outside of Hebrew scriptures as well. There's Egyptian sources that read surprisingly like the Hebrew scriptures, if not almost word for word, like they had the same teachers, they had the same, a lot of crossover. When wisdom literature emerges early on, especially with Proverbs, it's an older book, in general the philosophy is this: if you do good, if you work hard, you'll get your reward. If you do not do good, if you are not wise, if you are not following the ways of the righteous, there's lots of different ways to name this, you'll suffer for it. You'll be punished. You'll have consequences. Again, there's lots of different ways that you can kind of name that. There's a certain truth to this, isn't there? In a first half of life sort of way. I mean, you've seen it, right? Lazy people, sometimes they suffer the consequences, mm-hmm. right?
Or people on welfare because they're lazy. Intentionality.
I don't know if we want to get into the whole welfare.
No, it's not true, but yeah. I'm saying that's the perception very often that's put on people. And that's a cultural perception.
But along comes Ecclesiastes, and to a certain extent, Job kind of speaks an alternate voice to this as well. This is kind of why Ecclesiastes is sometimes talked about as the minority report. And what do you hear Ecclesiastes saying? Both the righteous and the unrighteous suffer alike. Mm-hmm. Which also has a certain truth to it, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. And don't be too righteous.
Don't be too righteous. Yeah. This, I hope if one thing that you might take away is hearing Ecclesiastes as a different way of thinking about the voices within the Bible. it isn't like everybody agrees in the Bible that all these different voices are all contributing to the same trajectory, the same direction. The Proverbs, you know, name this certain truth, which really resonates with first half of life issues, building identity, building ego, constructing a life, doing good, which are important things. We don't want to. I don't know how to teach my 6-year-olds, my 8-year-old, and 5-year-old. You know, it doesn't really matter if you do good or do bad. These are not the words that I hear coming out of my mouth. Be a good boy, right? I mean, which I have to caution, I have to be a little careful of. But these are important things, I think, in the formation of young people's lives, is teaching them good and evil, right? And yet, it's not the only truth to life.
Know when they're ready to, as Bonnie put it, take on the gray. And that's different. Kids don't come with manuals. You don't know when it's time to start introducing more of the gray. I would suspect for Elijah, you're probably already doing
There's
that.
Some, yeah.
You're already doing that, yeah. Just knowing him. And, you know, I think that, yeah. In all the years that I spent with kids, there were some who were in their teens and really couldn't deal with gray at all. So.
And learning that doing only good isn't going to put you in the clear by any means. You're still going to have to go through hardships that might not make any sense. You might wonder why they like come into your life, but that's just part of your experience.
And Job, I mean, really focuses around the question of suffering even more than Ecclesiastes. Why do bad things happen to good people? For Ecclesiastes, it seems to be a little different focus around work and toil, you know, this language of toil and what, even if you do lots of good work, there's still not the... There's still the possibility that things are going to fall apart. Yeah. In our last 5 minutes, are there other things that you want to ask about Ecclesiastes? Are there things that you still don't like about Ecclesiastes? That's fine too. Things that you want to wrestle with? Things that surprised you?
On chapter 5, verse 4, talking about making a vow to God. If you make a vow, you better keep it. Better to not make a vow than to keep it.
It reminds me of some of the... There's several places where Ecclesiastes sort of names the living, names... those who have died, and then circles back and says, but the best of all is the one who never lived in the first place. I don't know if it's a rhetorical device, but, you know, there's people who have named vows and then broken those vows. It's best if you don't make any vows in the first place, kind of circling around. I don't know what to make of that, but seems like there's a parallel there.
I kind of like the fact, I don't think the author has given up on God's promise or on his sense of who he is as a person of faith, let us say, but I don't know what they would have called it back then. So even though he puts all these warnings out there, he doesn't question if the faithfulness of the Creator in that sense.
You don't get the sense that at the end of the book, Ecclesiastes just puts his hands up and says, let's all be heroin junkies.
Yeah.
I
think he's reflecting on life more for me, for what he's observed and experienced. And he's saying, and maybe we all have it wrong, or very often we chase after the wrong goals. And if anything, it comes off as a warning for me not to get too caught up in my own brilliance. Because most people will point out to me it's not as many watts as I think it might be. Well, it took me a long, even like you mentioned Job before, but yeah, a long time to appreciate what he was really trying to do there. And he was talking about staying faithful to the promise. And his friends didn't get that.
That phrase, chasing after wind, that's appears again and again, really resonated from the standpoint that as you look at your own life and what's going on around you, is what we're about, are we chasing the wind, or is there a purpose in what we're doing? And I just thought that was really important. At least that's the way I kept reading it, as it appeared over and over again throughout the many examples of pointlessness, and just saying, yeah, that's the way it will be if you're just chasing the wind. So think about it.
I love that word chasing has kind of a connotation of eating as well. It's sometimes translated herding, and you herd cattle so that they have something to eat, pasture them. So there's this connotation of eating after the wind as well. And I think about the prayer that we probably do the most often, the table prayer number 7, which really has some resonance, I think, with Ecclesiastes. To eat is heaven. It's futile. There's futility in it, because you eat and then you get hungry again, right? And yet there is this little bit of heaven that is captured in eating when you sit and enjoy a good glass of wine with good company, or a good meal. And I think Ecclesiastes kind of asks, is that enough for today?
That's why I wanted to put into prayer number 7 a little carrot, to eat with friends. Or to play a game.
Any last bits of wisdom that you all have?
I don't know if this is wisdom, but how mine ends it is, fear God and keep all his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing that we're doing. So even if this is all it is, we should keep his commandments.
I'm thinking that this is all, there's too many of us here that are older, right?
No.
And so we say, it's good looking back and stuff, but youth and growing up is so exciting, and there's so many things to look forward to and so many things to do. I don't know, that just came to me because, young people, that you have to have that hope of things to do, the way you live your life. That probably didn't make any sense.
No, I think it does. I think, the author of Ecclesiastes might add, and don't spend your whole life wishing you were somewhere that you aren't. If you consider yourself an elder, enjoy that part of life. Don't wish that you were younger. If you are in your youth, enjoy your youth, and don't wish that you were at a later stage of life. Be enjoy. I mean, that word enjoy, there's so much more to it. But rejoice, be grateful, live in gratitude for the place that you are now.
You have so many different paths you can take.
Yeah.
Decide what's right with you.
Thank you all. Maybe that is a good place to conclude.